It's almost impossible to avoid consuming pesticides nowadays because they can be found in so much of our food. What kinds and in what amounts can have a significant impact on our health? Joining us for this week's Please Explain segment is Urvashi Rangan, Director of Consumer Safety for Sustainability at Consumer Reports, which has just released a new report on pesticides. Dr. Rangan is here to help us understand what these various pesticides are, their effects on the environment and on pollinators, and how to choose the best produce. Urvashi, welcome back to our show.
Thanks so much, Leonard. It's great to be here.
And we invite our listeners to join the conversation during these segments. You can give us a call at 212-433-9692 or leave a question on our show page at wmyc.org. You can also join in on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Urvashi, don't humans have a long history of trying to kill or suppress organisms that inhibit or prevent the growth of crops? When did pesticide use on an industrial scale begin?
Well, that's a great question. And really, it was after World War II, after we had developed a lot of chemical nerve warfare agents, and we realized the killing potential of those agents. Pesticides, especially in those early days, really were derivative of those chemicals. And so we started our sort of industrial agriculture system really after World War II, diluting those types of agents down and using them for their very toxic potential on insects and on weeds.
Well, since they were originally designed to affect humans, nerve warfare, was there any concern at the time that if we eat a lot of them, that we're always told to eat our veggies, that
that might
have an impact on us as well?
I think that's also a really good question. You know, the way we regarded chemical use in our society back then was it will only be used on the target we intend it for and will go away. Or we can dump these things on the ground and they won't go on past the fence line. And what we've learned in very painful ways and the painful lessons are a lot of these pesticides that we used, we didn't understand the full effects of them. We started to understand those health effects once the people who were working with them started to become sick. We knew that once we put it in the environment, a lot of the times it could stay in the environment, and it didn't just stay where we put it. It moved, and it contaminated ground and water and really started to move around. And so our entire understanding of chemical use in the environment, with a focus today on farming, but it's really in any case, really has different lessons than what we went in with it. And we need to use those better understandings today to make better decisions. And when it comes to being exposed to multiple ones of these, even today, we have a handle maybe on what one insecticide or herbicide does toxicity-wise, but we don't have a handle on the combined effects of multiple exposures. And that's why, in a lot of ways, we need to be taking proper precautions today to make sure that we don't sort of suffer those same lessons of yesterday.
And your report reveals that 700 million pounds of pesticides are used by U.S. farmers per year. What percentage of those chemicals, natural or synthetic, are affecting our water supply,
for
example?
Well, that's just a huge amount of chemical to begin with, isn't it? And we have tolerances, meaning that we allow the use of something like 9,000 chemicals out there on the market, and about 40 of those are classified as probable or possible carcinogens. Many of them have not even been well understood enough to be classified. Even last week, glyphosate, which is one of the most widely used herbicides today, in large part due to GMO crops, was just classified by IARC, which is the cancer organization attached to the World Health Organization, as being probably carcinogenic to humans. So again, we're still learning those lessons. We don't really know the full extent of what's going to happen from everything that is in the environment, but pesticides can be found in our waterways, in our air, in communities that live near farms. It's pretty well documented wanted that once we use this much in the environment, that it can persist in the environment. And we've done a lot of work on arsenic in our food supply, and while the most toxic pesticides that contain arsenic, lead arsenate, for example, have been banned for decades, those pesticides still persist in our environment, and they can still contaminate our food supplies. And even today, we allow what we call organic arsenic. That has nothing to do with organic production. But we still do things that impart arsenic into our environment. We use those pesticides on cotton and lawns and rights of ways. And again, we think those practices really need to stop. We need to stop putting that stuff into our environment where we can potentially elevate the levels of arsenic in our food supply, let alone the damage it may do to the environment itself.
And then arsenic is introduced to our food naturally through rice, isn't it?
Well, that's the issue, is when you look at some of these crops and where they're grown, whether the arsenic is there naturally or whether it was there because of previous pesticide use, or even feeding poultry arsenic, which is a practice we've been doing for decades and we still allow, and then that fertilizer can be used on crops. All those ways lead certain foods like rice to take it up from the soil. Rice in particular, as we've noted in a previous study we've done, really likes to take arsenic up from the soil. So again, the interaction between what we plant, what's in the soils, what can be taken up, we don't necessarily explore all those issues before we plant things out there. And our philosophy at Consumer Reports is we need to be putting less of this stuff into the environment. We need to be using less chemically and drug-intensive systems in our agriculture production, because we learn these lessons every time. And even beyond that, when it comes to resistance, whether it's an antibiotic making a bacteria more resistant, or a pesticide where the crop itself becomes resistant, or what it's being used for becomes resistant. In the case of glyphosate, the weeds have become more and more resistant to its use, and so now we're switching over, in the case of these GMO crops, to more toxic pesticides like 2,4-D. Resistance is science. It's what happens. And so in a way, relying on a system that uses these things that exacerbates the problem of resistance is really a race to the bottom.
I'm talking with Urvashi Rangan, Director of Consumer Safety for Sustainability at Consumer Reports. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. We'll be taking your calls in a little while at 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter. Our handle is at Leonard Lopate. We're talking about a wide range of pesticides, aren't we? Any chemical or mix of chemicals that would make up a fungicide, an herbicide, an anti-fouling agent, or a biocide, are they all very different?
They are very different in terms of their intended purposes, but all of them, not all of them, but many of them do carry toxic potential. When we conducted this particular study, one of the things we did is we looked at data that was gathered by the U.S. Department of Agriculture on residues found in produce. They test a good handful of produce for different pesticide residues, not all of them, mind you, about 70% of the pesticides that are allowed to be used. And they quantify the amount of residues they have found on individual samples. So taking this very large data set and looking for crops in the last year that we have testing data for them, we took that information and we looked at the combination of residues that could be found on any given crop. And then we looked at how often they were found on that particular crop. And we crunched a risk index based on that. And so that's one way to be able to start to look at the toxicity of these things. We then used EPA data on the maximum reference doses for some of these residues and summed them up in terms of how often you might encounter them. We base the absolute risk on a child because those are really part of our vulnerable populations. Children have developing nervous and immune systems. They're also smaller and get greater exposures pound for pound. So you can look at the list that we've created for 50 fruits and vegetables and see which ones were the highest risk. And Green beans, for example, pop to the top of that list, and they're in our high-risk category. And there really are no other alternatives, conventional alternatives, that are lower risk. And in that case, it's an example of where we say, you know, if you can, you should always buy organic of green beans. And there's about 5 vegetables and 5 fruits we have that recommendation for. In many other cases, at least for now, for the consumer, if you're concerned about the residues themselves, there are some low conventional options. At the end of the day, we don't want this report to deter people from eating fruits and vegetables. That's the most important thing you can do. But we do think there are opportunities to improve the safety and the health of our agriculture system, which not only benefits us who eat it at the end, but the people who are handling all of this stuff at the farm, who are working with these agents, and for the environment as well.
Now, we were told in the past that we could just wash the strawberries or the apples, and that would eliminate a lot of the problem. Is that true?
No, not exactly. In a lot of cases, you can wash the outside. It really depends on the pesticide itself and what the intended use is. If it's a systemic pesticide, for example, it will get inside of the fruit. When the USDA tests a lot of what they do, they do peel things like oranges or tangerines. And so tangerines are another example of a high-risk conventional fruit that we found where we recommend organic is the best alternative. And in that case, when the USDA tested that, they peeled the tangerine, and it was really what was inside of it that had the pesticide. These new group of pesticides called neonicotinoids, listeners may have heard of those. In Europe, they've taken some pretty strong actions to restricting and eliminating their use because of their concern regarding bee populations and colony collapse disorder. We haven't quite taken those steps here, but we at Consumer Reports are very concerned about the use of neonicotinoids, and those are examples of systemic pesticides that can get inside of things. That's how they exhibit their mode of action. So in general, we think, you know, you should wash your produce. That will be very helpful, and you should wash it with water and a brush. That's the best thing to use. You don't need to use any of the washes that are out on the market. But that said, in looking at these particularly high-risk foods, sometimes you can't get around that entirely by just washing them.
Some of the pesticides are called natural. Others are synthetic. Can natural pesticides be as toxic to living things as synthetic pesticides?
There are a few examples of natural pesticides that are particularly toxic, and rotenone on bananas is an example of one of those. There are times you can make synthetic versions even of something that's occurring naturally, and when you concentrate it down enough, it may very well exhibit some toxic properties. But what people need to understand is that most of what we're looking at in terms of these high-risk foods have to do with industrial pesticides, sort of the ones derivative of the most toxic pesticides. And compared to their organic counterparts that we look at in the database, organic almost universally comes in at low risk. So even looking at the toxicity indices of whatever residues are on organic, they don't rise to the same toxicity levels that some of these industrial ones do. And just one final thought on natural pesticides is that true organic production and true sustainable production will use biological or botanical controls to some degree. They also rely on physical controls, removing things with your hand and manually, and that's why it's so much more labor-intensive and costs more to produce. But that in that way, if you're not using chemicals, you're also creating a savings there. But natural pesticides do tend to break down better in the environment. And if you're not overusing them or over-concentrating them, you can use them within the natural ecology of what you're trying to do in a sustainable system, which is really to nurture nature and not try to override it. And that's really, I think, a fundamental principle here in terms of pesticide use and overriding nature nature and the consequences that we've seen from doing
now,
that.
Now, nature provides what is called a biorational approach. I remember years ago the Gallo brothers started introducing ladybugs and other things into their vineyards. It was pointed out that they hadn't done it because they were ardent environmentalists, but simply because they thought it was actually a better approach for their grapes.
I think that's right, Leonard. You know, so many organic and sustainable producers chose to go that way because of, I think, what they were seeing in the environment and knowing that the environment actually provides an amazing resource in terms of insect control and balance and insect predators for other insects and really trying to grow things under that framework. And nature offers so many scientific lessons to us. And in a way, nature can often do it best. That isn't always the case, but it sure often is. And in organic production, they also learned that there were benefits to the farm workers, that there were some really severe human disease consequences going on for farm workers and their children just coming home with the stuff on their clothing, having their wives and children be exposed to it, or even children in the womb. And there are, frankly, very large cohort studies out there that have been following those farm workers for years. So the combination of knowing that what someone was doing on their farm and the direct effects that they could see was in large part what prompted a lot of people to go back in time before World War II, back to organic practices, where you didn't see that same kind of consequence go on.
A recent book has argued that we have upset the natural balance by importing plants that aren't indigenous to a specific environment, that in the older way, the ladybugs, the spiders, the bees, the butterflies, et cetera, would be attracted to plants that were natural to the area, and they would eliminate all of the, they would kill off the pests that weren't really good for the plants. But that's not the case anymore.
Well, we've definitely overridden a lot of things, and, you know, weeds are very interesting. Herbicides are used to kill weeds. And even here in this country, even without imported plants and invasive plants, we've created our own super weeds that will resist it. When it comes to some of those beneficial predators, their populations have definitely been compromised. We know with bees, we've got a real concern going on. And people may not know in China, for example, where there was a lot of pesticide overuse, there are not many bees, and apple and pear trees are literally hand-pollinated because there's not a pollinator to do that. In this country, the use of glyphosate has actually done enough to the milkweed population of weeds that has compromised our monarch butterfly populations. And just recently, Shelley Pingree from Maine introduced a bill putting monarch butterflies under the Endangered Species Act. So there's no question, again, that the disruption to nature from these things and the indiscriminate sort of use and targeting of their toxic effects has had consequences that then have additional consequences.
So, Irvashi, should I be planting milkweed in my backyard?
Why not? Why not, Leonard? Because I think, again, that's something that the monarch butterfly relies on. And without that, that's why their populations have sort of severely declined. But I think this problem is more than what each of us as individuals can do, although everybody should be thinking about this when it comes to their gardens, what you're using on them. These pesticides that are out there are also available commercially, and we'll be doing more at Consumer Reports to get people that information about home and lawn and garden care. But thinking about organic production, looking to people like Rodale, who really have very good information on how you cultivate and nurture nature to do the work you need it to do, because when you have a really healthy soil and you have a healthy ecosystem, you actually need to do less to control weeds and pests.
My guest is Arvashi Rangan, Director of the Consumer Safety for Sustainability at Consumer Reports. We will continue with today's Please Explain segment. Your calls at 212-433-9692 or your comments on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate, right after this. And we are back with Arvashi Rangan, Director of Consumer Safety for Sustainability at Consumer Reports. We're talking about the use of pesticides in our food, there's been a recent report by Consumers Report on just what happens when we eat these things. We'll be taking your calls in just a moment, but I wanted to deal with the things that remain in our bodies, metabolites. What's a metabolite?
Like anything we process, our liver is responsible for metabolism and has enzymes that metabolize things. So just like when pesticides go through our bodies, we will metabolize them, and sometimes those metabolites can stay with us for depending on how long their half-life is. That said, the Center for Disease Control estimates that people can have up to 29 different pesticide residues or metabolites in their bodies. And again, that indicates sort of the panoply, the many different pesticides we can be exposed to all at one time.
Do we know whether they're causing problems? Because whenever these things go to court, the case never really gets made.
They don't. And part of the problem there is you need bodies to have the absolute proof that there is a problem. And when toxicology and the field of toxicology is only at the level of understanding the toxicity of one individual compound at one time, it becomes very difficult to then say, well, we don't know what 29 of these does together, but I guess we'll just base it on one by one. What we know is that the combination can have additive effects. Maybe it can even have synergistic effects. And we should be concerned about that combination of residues. What we also know is that some of them do have very toxic properties. We've talked about how these things are toxic by design. And one philosophy, again, we have at our center at Consumer Reports is we should expose ourselves to less bits of carcinogen everywhere we can, less heavy metals everywhere we can. And so we know there's sort of these big differences in these residue levels, and exposing yourself to less, we think, is a healthier option. When it comes to a court case ruling on that, some people will say, well, exposure doesn't prove harm. And that's true. Exposure doesn't prove harm. But we believe in something called precautionary principle, which is a principle that's applied much more in Europe than here, which is that if there's enough information to suggest there may be harm, then and there are alternatives available, why not move toward those? And that taking cautions to avoid risk altogether is a good idea.
Let's take a call from Julie from Hastings. Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, thanks, Leonard. Thanks for your great show. My question has to do with two structural factors having to do with corporate influence. One is whether the influence of U.S. Agricultural policy over the last 70 years, our tax dollars supporting, it would seem, agribusiness, which I understand uses far more pesticide per acre than a family farm. And the second influence, possibly, and maybe the guests could address this, maybe corporate influence on the American Cancer Society. I mean, why is it true that they do not really emphasize trying to figure out whether pesticides cause cancer to some extent?
You want to answer that? And by the way, I want to add to that question a third question, which is federal policy is designed to keep food prices down. But you keep on talking about how organic may be better in many cases. Organic food is not really subsidized by the government, and organic prices are quite high in some cases, a reason that many people say they can't afford it.
So let me start with the top of the questions. These are all really good ones. There's no question that the industry behind pesticide use and really industrial agriculture out there is incredibly powerful, and it does drive policy. And I think that we do need more and more independent groups who can actually decode what's going on here and make better sense of it for the American public. And groups like some of these cancer associations get a lot of money from the industry, and it's not always clear on the surface because the group sounds like a so-called public interest group. So it's really important, as people are hearing information and maybe questioning it, to kind of dig down a little deeper as to who might actually be behind telling you some of that information. In terms of federal policies, I think that they can be very influential on them. And even just today, we're seeing news from one of the big companies saying people don't drink glyphosate, so it's really not a problem, and don't worry about the recent cancer classification. We think that kind of response is irresponsible. The question about organics and do we think it's better? Absolutely. I'd love to see in 20 years that organic agriculture becomes obsolete because we've taken the bottom up and moved it toward organic production. The prices can be quite high. In our 40-page report that we do have posted online for free, we try to give people a lot of good tips for buying organic in season and getting the best value out of it.
And we want to bring Gerald from the Bronx in here to join this conversation. Hi, Gerald.
Hi.
Go ahead.
How are you? I just wanted to ask Ms. Rankin, how do we verify the authenticity of organic fruits and vegetables? How can we truly know that they are organic and not just being labeled as such when we buy from the supermarket?
And aren't the rules a little hazy in some cases, Ravashi?
Look, we watchdog the organic standards and have for 15 years, and there are things that need to be improved upon, but that program itself is quite solid, and people can't make claims about being organic unless they're certified. And if you find that people are, if you're at a farmer's market and somebody's saying, I'm organic, but I'm not certified because I didn't want to go through the paperwork, then they're not certified as organic. And they may be doing things, and they should explain what they are doing, but they're not that. In general, you can rely on that label to mean what a set of standards behind it does. And there really are almost no industrial pesticides allowed for use on organic production. And like I say, when we look at these toxicity risks from organic produce that has been tested, they're always low or very low. And in addition, we just know from those standards how much better it is for the farm. Now, could it be better over time? It could be. And things like biodynamic build on organic. They make it even better. And you see biodynamic a lot at the farmer's market. We have in that 40-page report a whole review on all the labels you might see. Whole Foods is coming out with their own pesticide label program that actually has four steps to it. And we've rated all of them in that report so you can get a handle on which labels are required to do what and the verification that they have.
And we have a link to that report on our show page at WNYC.org. I guess they can also get it from Consumer Reports?
That's right. The report and all the reports are there for free as well at Consumer Reports. For us, this is a safety study and part of our public service mission, and we want to provide that all for free to consumers.
Cherry on Twitter asks, how safe is packaged produce that says it's been washed? Is it safe enough, or do you still have to wash it?
You know, that was a little outside of the scope of this study. I can tell you from an older study we've done on bagged produce back in 2010, and so it's a little old now, that the closer you got to expiration date on the bagged produce, the more bacteria, not pathogens, but filth bacteria, you could find. In general, You know, if you can buy your produce out of a bag, we think that's the best option because you don't truck it as far. It may not be rinsed in chlorine as much. And so in that sense, they're not sort of overly processed. But that's what I can tell you about bagged produce.
Now, just one more thing. We've been talking about farming, but we've heard about someone who works at a grain shipping station on the St. Lawrence River. His job is to spray tons and tons of grain with pesticides. Those chemicals, we can't wash them off. How should we approach cereals and grains? And, Arvash, we have very little time for you to give us an answer.
It's a great question, and I think people should know that we do treat things even after we harvest them, whether they're in a storage box or in terms of treating grains. And this is exactly why we need a more holistic approach to the use of these chemicals in our food production system.
A listener, Vic, says that one of the pesticides used a lot now, 24D, was used in Agent Orange. Is that true?
It was a component of Agent Orange, and they've reformulated it and reformulated some of the droplet sizes and things like that. But this is not a good move. This is not something that we as a society should be moving toward to bring out some of these old, more toxic pesticides back into the fray simply because we now have resistance to the ones we've been overusing.
Can I be tested to find out whether I have high levels of toxicity?
You know, you can do that, and I think, look, in our viewpoint, this is not a reason for everybody to go out and get their urine or blood tested, and that's not the kind of, I think, fear and loathing we want to cultivate. It's really important to eat your fruits and vegetables, even the conventional ones, and nothing should deter you from that because we know the benefits of eating more than even 5 servings of fruits and vegetables a day.
Thank you so much, Arvashi.
Okay, thank you so much.
Arvashi Rangan is the Director of Consumer Safety for Sustainability at Consumer Reports. We have linked to their latest study on our show page at WNYC.org. Thank you so much for being on our show again.